Welcome. This is Why Life Is. I'm Niles McFlower. Tonight, we are going to be talking about the interrelationship of the energy and plant kingdoms. And it sounds like a kind of complicated subject, but it is really about how a planet develops life and how these kingdoms are so dependent upon each other, to say the least. And how, in looking at it from the big picture, from the picture of God, so to speak, there is a necessity to build up a system that will work in the exchange or proper exchange of energy so that eventually a planet will be able to sustain life. And interestingly, it's sometimes easier to create initial life. And I know that's a, for a lot of people, that sounds like the big problem, but it isn't. The big problem is in the sustaining, for any significant period of time, life on a planet. Initial life, is not that hard. Now, why am I saying that? Well, it's because if we look at the very primitive proto, we'll call them, cells that were developed a long time ago. The process, while cells are just amazing things, the process of creating a cell is within definable parts of existence, is basically not that complicated if you have a lot of time. So, given enough time, you could create a cell, which in itself is marvelous. Now, most people say, well, what about RNA and DNA and all that stuff? Well, that's even in some respects, a little bit faster than the development of a cell. So, it isn't as impossible to do those things as a lot of people think that it might be. The really tricky part about life is sustaining it beyond the levels that we just talked about. When you get to the point where you want life to support a planet and the planet to support life, the life changes the planet and oftentimes produces effects that destroys it. And so you have to have a balance. And the balance is the trick to the whole situation. And if you don't know where you're going, you won't be able to get there very easily or quickly enough for life to sustain itself. That's an important concept, and that's going to be part of tonight's show. Let me explain what I just said. Let's say that we are observers, but not creators of life. And we're just trying to observe how life, quote-unquote, evolves on a planet. It would appear to us initially what I just said, that given enough time and enough combinations, it's possible to create pieces of nucleic acids that eventually become part of what we call ribonucleic acid, which is a special kind of acid that eventually is able to replicate itself based upon a structure of chemistry. But it's a little more complicated than that, but we'll say that that's its foundation. And then that communicator of life can become part of DNA, which allows not only for the life to replicate, but to store and to make internal changes to what will eventually become a cell. All of this that I'm talking about is very important because it suggests that to a person who's just simplistically observing it, well, life doesn't need God. You know, hey, there's no need for anything here because it can eventually do it for itself. It just needs enough time. Well, yes, there's some truth to that. And you could even make that argument up to the point that I just stopped. But then you get another problem. You see, life requires continuous resources. And the resources that are available to start life are usually insufficient to sustain life. You have to have a balance of different lives, and different things going on a planet, all together in an orchestration which is extremely complicated over time, so that life continues to grow and sustains itself beyond its initial development. And that's the trick. Some of this involves oceans, and it involves atmospheres, and it involves changes in temperatures and changes in mineral availabilities and all kinds of things that different parts of life affect. It's this interrelationship that you would need to know about way ahead of time, like millions and millions of years ahead of time on a beginning planet. The beginning, say, of Earth's existence, to be able to get from having some life that exists for some period of time, doesn't just destroy itself, or the planet effectively destroys if you look at it from that point of view, compared to life that supports itself through interchanging itself through what we would call changes in the energy and matter availability, chemistry, and physics of a planet. And so when you look at that from that standpoint, you'd say, well, the life has to be some kind of genius kind of life. But where does the genius come from if life is a bunch of chemicals that just come together and bingo? That's the point. Evolution has never explained that, and it can't. And Francis Crick, who is two people actually, but maybe some other people helped to find DNA and the true structure of DNA, stated that it would take 5 times, 10 times longer for life to be able to have done what I just explained it needs to do in order to exist on a planet like Earth. So his conclusion is there's something else that's thinking for the life, and it isn't the chemicals. You got your thought now enters into the equation, and that means evolution, as we sometimes believe it to be, which is based more upon forces and energies between one thing and another, starting with molecules. This is the way life is sustained, created, and sustained, and it just does not work mathematically. It doesn't work. You can, when you start putting the variables in, there's no way to make it work within the time period. Even if we're talking about 5 billion years, that's a long time. 5 billion years? Yeah, but the problem is, it's not the 5 billion years that's the problem, that all life will be gone within less than 1 billion years from the time it started to exist, because it would be out of balance and be unable to achieve what it's doing. Unless you want to believe that we are one out of a trillion, trillion, trillion type of planets, and there is no life anywhere else that has sustained itself. And I guess that's really going to be the bottom line in determining the foundation of everything. Because if Earth were the only planet, or maybe one of 5, or 10, in the entire known universe, which is really just one dimension, but that's a whole other issue, but the physical universe, then you might conclude that this is the one time it just happened that way. And we can get away with that possible argument. But once we find other planets that have sustained life for more than millions of years, but for longer periods of time than that, then the crit theory comes into play, and many other people who have proposed the same thing, and it just doesn't mathematically work out. You've got to have a time period, not of 5 billion years, but probably 50 billion years. The problem is that the known universe hasn't existed that long. That would create a very big problem for the evolution theory, you see. And this is a significant argument. Now, tonight's show is really not about specifically what I just stated, but I think starting with the big picture on this is pretty helpful because it kind of gives us a reason to want to explore how the parts of this whole system work, because we'll have more appreciation for it and realizing that it isn't purely a mechanical model. There is a huge super thought that's going in to how the system works. Even our grand supercomputers of today would have a very hard time going through all of the interrelated ways that life has to support itself and a planet at the same time and how it all interacts together. It isn't a single thing by any stretch. It's into the zillions of probabilities and possibilities. Yet it does happen, in my opinion, very frequently. Why do I say that? Because we're starting to see planets that are Earth sort of like and that indicate by their gases that there's a good chance there's life on them. At least they've already discovered a half dozen or more possible candidates out of out of 700 or 800. And it's growing every day. It may be over 1,000 because I don't know. I don't keep up with it every month or so, and it keeps growing. But just in a very small universe relative of the visible planets, we're already seeing some that likely have life on them by their chemistry only. And so it's starting to look like, well, it isn't like a one out of a zillion possibility. It may be a few out of 1,000. Well, that's what we can pick up now. What if life was there a million years ago or is going to be there a million years from now? And you get into all these things and you start saying, wow, that's starting to look like there's a likelihood that life is abundant and survivable past a certain point. Now, these planets, some of them that they've discovered, are in more mature stars like ours that ultimately have been around for a very long time. And to still have life on them means that they had to have gone past the quagmire of not just starting life, but sustaining it. And for probably billions of years, life has been on those planets that we're looking at. So it's a really interesting idea. And again, I bring this up at the beginning of the show so that we can appreciate the interrelationship of the energy and plant kingdoms. And of course, the rest of the show is going to be much more, we'll say, metaphysically in foundation than what I just said, which is really more of a scientific and mathematical inquiry, statistically, than what I'm going to be doing with the rest of the time, because the rest of the time is to talk about something that most people don't even know about. That's called the energy kingdom. How could it be a kingdom of energy anyway? You know, that's a thing that a lot of people have trouble with. Now, I had several shows, one fairly recently, on just the energy kingdom, so I'm not going to repeat that show. I'm going to say some things that I said in it with extra information, but mostly be talking about how those things relate to the plant kingdom, because although it is it's correct to state that if you go back to those early cells I talked about, some of them became eventually animals and some eventually became plants. Plants probably preceded animals by a little bit of time. But before that, there were cells that were really indistinguishable, we could call them, going in either direction. And they made, things that we would call free plant of a sort, you know, such as algae and certain kinds of bacteria. And a lot of people prefer to say the algae are more plant-like in some ways and the bacteria are more animal-like in some ways. But in reality, neither one of those kinds of life back in the time at the beginning of this planet had much differences. They were kind of, The odd thing about them is they actually got together. So it's hard for us to say that they were really separate kingdoms at that point, if like bacteria literally became part of some parts of algae. You know, how do you explain that? Well, it actually did happen, yeah. And so other things that we don't normally think of as being, you know, possible, that actually did take place. And it was necessary for it to take place. And that's one of the things that's so amazing. If it hadn't taken place, life would have ended. And there's so many of those life would have ended statements that it just is amazing that the obstacle course to get to a place where you're a sustained planet is, it's just everywhere. There's one thing after another that comes into play that if you don't plan for millions of years ahead of time, you're going to be out of luck. Just literally, because you can't change the atmosphere of the planet that fast, or you can't change the way the oceans function that fast, or the gases that exist in the oceans, or the minerals that are presently being affected in certain ways by the life in the oceans and eventually on land. It's so fascinating that all of these things have to come together. But there's a more basic side to this, and I say this with some humility, that the energy kingdom, which is barely known by most people, is a critical element, and it is so hidden or esoteric that it is the reason that people have such a hard time believing in God, because most of the things that the energy kingdom does can be explained away by chances and other things that really can't happen the way that it really happens, but that people prefer to make up other reasons if they don't believe in God and are strict structural evolutionists, which means they don't believe in God usually. And they're usually very socially progressive-minded people who seek to separate the concept of spiritual from form. And so to them, there's just the form world, the sort of logical positivist. If it's you can tangibly feel it, then it's real. And if it's not that way, you can't. It's not real. Of course, their two senses of spirits are probably dysfunctional to some extent, either by choice or by some other factors in people like that. And there's a lot of folks like that. Maybe 15% or so of the population in the United States are truly into that vein. Okay, so getting to this energy kingdom. The energy kingdom is a kingdom that works the reverse way in development of consciousness to what we are used to in terms of being a non-energy part of the kingdom. I mean, a non-part of the energy kingdom. The energy kingdom, as it becomes more, we'll call it, dense, loses its ability to develop itself and becomes, we'll call it, gravitationally attracted to other energy, but it doesn't have a sense of consciousness in general. And it develops this by a thing we call involution rather than evolution. What is involution? Involution means that, just like I said, as it in metaphysics, it means that it becomes less and less conscious as it becomes more and more dense. And this level of lacking consciousness is not a terrible thing, because it is part of God's plan that there be a sufficient level of form for spirit to inhabit. Okay. Now you have to take a leap with me on this if you are, you know, not believing spiritually, but it's, I mean, you probably wouldn't be listening to the show tonight, but you might be. Maybe you stumbled and said, well, let's just have a listen. Okay, so the spiritual part is really God's thought itself, which is in all life, to some extent. And this spirit needs to express itself through form in order to exist as a full part of God, because God is both spirit and its intelligent activity, but when the activity is not perfectly intelligent, it manifests itself as energy. And energy eventually becomes all matter in all form. So energy is really the basis of the form part of life from what is called the third or atmic plane down. Down being lower towards where we are today, which is the lowest dimension of time and space, the physical dimension. And so this amazing part, we'll say, that's hidden, is composed of energy that both is in fluid form, we'll call it, where it exists in a state of both wave and particle, and then it moves in a very denser form where the waves become more and more restricted by the overparticleization or solidification of what we eventually call over-dimensionally, over different and deeper dimensional space, solid matter. And so the good news is that we couldn't be here now, I couldn't be here now, but we could be here now, if we didn't have some parts of energy involuting into a solid form, because we need that here to survive. Spirit without form is kind of unable to create anything on its own, and it becomes a consciousness with no particular reason for existence. And that's why it makes a meaningless activity to be in such a state, which of course is not the purpose of life. Life is to balance the form with the spirit. The third part of God's mind is the form part, we'll call it. It starts out as intelligent, perfectly intelligent activity, which has perfect communication with all other things, and as soon as it becomes less than perfect, it divests itself into matter eventually, but first into energy that can, some of it can become matter. And we need matter where we're at, because that's the kind of form that works here. At least in the densest part of the physical plane where we are, but we also exist electromagnetically, which is sometimes referred to as the etheric part, and that part actually doesn't have the same density. It is composed mostly of the stronger wave parts of energy with less particleization, less density, and so that's still part of this dimension, except we don't take much notice of it, except we couldn't exist if it didn't exist, because it's the primary source of where we are able to maintain life, even though we don't recognize that. Most people don't. All right, so energy is a very big deal, and life needs a great deal of tweaking of energy in the physical realm, including the electromagnetic or etheric parts, in order for life to be sustainable. The tweaking is because there is so much specialization that takes place as something becomes denser. The particleization gives life what we call diversity. Specialization, diversity, and individualness. You lose all of those things, including individualness, if you don't begin life in the physical world. A lot of people ask me on occasion, why can't we create life in the astral world? Because there's some people have read some books I've read, and it says the next dimension, next major dimension of time and space, the astral world, where everybody goes, or almost everybody goes, who's physically alive when they die, eventually goes there. some people stay in the etheric realm for a while, watch what's going on, but they can't do much. Because, again, they're mostly spirit with not much form to do much with, so they can, you know, they leave within usually days to a few weeks. And they go to the astral realm. But in the astral realm, you can't start life there, and there's a very good reason for it. You wouldn't be much of an individual. The individuality that we call ourselves comes from an interaction between our personality and self in dealing with the forces that exist in a solid part of a dimension, which is where we are in the physical world. And that is the thing that is so important for us to have so that we develop a individual self. Now, how do I know this? I mean, I could be creating that in my head, right? Well, I have done some traveling, we'll call it, to the astral realm in using some, at first, artificial means, and eventually I could do it just by doing it. But the point is that what I discovered, and some of you have read this, is that children, when they die from the physical world, they take a lot longer, most of them, unless they developed a very strong self early in life, take a lot longer to develop in the astral world. You've read that, and a lot of people accept it as true. Some people have astral traveled themselves and found that to be true. But the point is there's a reason for it, and the reason is this. The reason it takes so much longer to grow up is because they were deprived of the more critical time to develop their self in the physical world by an early death. And it's that struggle of the forces that develops the self faster, and even the personality in up to the first 10 years of life or so, so that the person grows up faster. The only exception to that are people who have had many lifetimes of development of self and have a higher self, which doesn't ever go away, by the way. And so that higher self fills in the gap, and they get to the astral world, if they're children. If they can make it to the second subworld, which is high, believe me, those children are actually, they don't have deficiency in self. As a matter of fact, they're more advanced, and they grow up faster, not slower. Everything reverses, because those folks didn't have to have the struggle in the first place to develop the higher self, which was always with them, because they've developed it through many prior lifetimes, and that doesn't go away. They are partly soul, in other words. And so it's so fascinating to see that there's a relationship here, and it has to do with spirit interacting with energy. Fascinating, fascinating. Even at the most fundamental and simple levels, we can see some way in relationship how human beings develop, as an example, why life has a certain reason for going into solid form. And struggle, it does. Boy, is it hard to struggle, and it's the energy that provides the struggle. The gravitational element of energy is so strong in the physical world, the dense physical world, that it is very difficult for life to sustain itself. Again, maybe not so hard to start life in the first place. I mean, that can be accounted for by just huge numbers of chances. But very difficult to sustain itself. There's too many forces that cause life to extinguish, to die. And so the energy kingdom provides an important resource. I think of it as a sacrifice, actually. The energy is coming from the third part of God's mind, which is pure intelligence, pure intelligent activity, meaning that every action extends or never wastes any energy in whatever it's doing. That means everything moves at the speed of light, of course. But besides that, there is no, and the light speed, again, changes based upon the quantum constant, depending upon what dimension you're on. But the fascinating part about this is that the energy has to decide to do this. I know it sounds wacko, but it's true. I mean, there's no law that says that energy at the spiritual plane, or sometimes referred to as atmic plane level, both of them the same place, has to de-evolve or to become involutionary and lose consciousness as it gains solidity for the purpose of growing life. There's nothing out there that says, boy, you got to do this. You know, it's the way of the world, and you're forced to do it. Energy decides this on its own. Now, I know people are going to read the textbook I wrote, and it says in there that some energy stays here and some goes there, and it has different levels of consciousness and whatever. That's all true. But when you get to at the very beginning of the thing, you start at the very beginning, the only thing you could say that's really true is that there's an elective here. Energy is seeking to grow more of its creator. And it becomes energy because it can't immediately do that until it cooperates with spirit. And because it wants to grow more of its creator, because it's the thought of the creator that it seeks to become one with, the energy is the part of the third part of God's mind that, in order to join with the first two parts, which is spirit, it's got to be able to do so by enabling the development of life on places like planets. And it's an amazing idea, because if you don't believe in God, it really becomes enigmatic that how is it that his energy is just doing this stuff? I mean, there's no law of physics that can apply to this. It's a law of God's mind. God chose for there to be increased life. And once that choice was made, the process becomes a part of energy itself. It seeks thought greater than whatever minimum thought it has, because the thought that is greater than it is its own creator. It seeks to rejoin in mind back to its creator. So we say, in those who are metaphysicians, those who have gone past regular physics and say, well, there's some metaphysics to this thing, greater than the known physics, that's what metaphysics means, that ultimately it's the mind of God that energy came from that causes it to constantly be attracted to thought greater than it possesses itself. And the law of metaphysics, which is a primary law, stated by several well-known authors before me, of course, is that energy follows thought greater than whatever level it functions at, or than its own. And this is the reason why, because it wants to rejoin with its creator, and it has an impulse to do that, but the only way it can do that is to de-evolve, to lose some of its consciousness as a sacrifice. It's a pretty amazing idea. So that, and a significant part of energy does this, so that life can be created at levels where consciousness can grow much faster. And you can end up with an amazing, we'll call it, dance between energy and eventually life. And of course, tonight we'll be talking about some of that life being plant life, but I'm starting off with the earlier concept, the earlier way of looking at this thing. And that's what's so fascinating about this. It's a dance. The energy is looking ahead, millions, hundreds of millions, billions of years ahead, to where life can be created on a planet, provided it develops solid form in the physical dimension, which is a vast, far away region from where it started, which is in the spiritual plane, the spiritual dimension. That's way beyond human consciousness and human understanding. And from that vantage point, it says, you know, for there to be more God, there needs to be an absolute and necessary, unfortunately necessary for the poor energy, sacrifice to become less conscious but more gravitational, more dense, and to particleize, losing some of its vibrational elements. Not completely, but some. And it does all this for the purpose that life will grow more, and eventually it will rejoin with its creator. But when it has, its consciousness and the consciousness of all life will be vastly greater and can rejoin in total with God. This story, starting here, I think, gives us a little pause, gives me a little pause to think about, wow, that's such a interesting way of looking at the beginning of the interrelationship. So it's really energy that's starting the whole situation. There are no plants in anything I just described yet, because energy has to choose all this billions of years in some cases, but for sure hundreds of millions of years ahead of the plants. And it's a pretty remarkable story in itself. Now, for those of you who still are probably scratching your head and saying, I don't quite get all this, you may have to read more than I can go into tonight. You can pick up a copy of the textbook I wrote, Life's Hidden Meaning, because that is where there's more explanation of the integral parts of everything that I just said, including monads and lots of things I'm not going to talk about tonight. But there's a lot to see how everything fits together. But I think the part that I did explain actually did more, maybe, than what I wrote in that textbook, because there wasn't room to put in all these explanations so that people could say, whoa, isn't that neat? It was more meant to be taught than to just be all written out, because even what I just explained would have taken a lot of room if you put it down into writing. All right, so we'll take a break at this point. I want you all to kind of let that all stir around in you, what I just explained. And when we come back, we'll go back into the interrelationship of the energy, which I think I covered pretty good, of what it was and how that fits into what the plant kingdom is. And I'll explain more about that when we come back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm a host. Well, I'm not even a host tonight. I'm just speaking. Niles McFlower. And, you know, it's interesting that when you start getting into the, we'll say, intricacies of energy, it becomes almost its own, we'll say, whole other realm compared to human beings. Because although I just described how energy envelopes, it also goes the other way, eventually. So it is so strange because it doesn't go in just one direction. The part that envelopes we call elemental energy, because it's the basic part of energy that creates what we call form. But eventually, energy has to do more than just provide the form. It has to provide the form in a dance or concert with other kingdoms. And that part requires more, we'll call it intelligence, than involutionary energy has, because it loses its intelligence and its consciousness, the ability to use the intelligence creatively, as it becomes denser and denser. But there's another part of energy, as it involutes, it reaches a maximum part of involution, and then it switches, because life itself helps it to switch, and it becomes devonic energy instead of elemental energy. Now, devonic energy is meaning that it, some people call it devas, you know, but it's energy that actually has consciousness, and it has consciousness that isn't individual until it reaches the higher mental world. In every place below that, it has a group kind of consciousness, which is fine for what it needs to do. So it works together with other parts of energy, including other devonic energies and with involutionary energy, and it tries to help energy to work better with life. So if we didn't have devonic energies, energy would be too slow, too unintelligent, to create life in the system or dance that we're going to be talking about tonight. And that creates all kinds of slowdowns and problems. And sometimes human beings create problems in the development of the devonic kingdom, part of sub-kingdom of the energy kingdom, and interfere with the relationship between devonic energy and elemental energy. When that happens, life declines. And the system that supports life becomes a system that supports death, and life, instead of growing, shrinks in life. And instead of evolving in consciousness, it de-evolves into lower and lower consciousness, and eventually may become almost non-conscious, or subconscious, or below conscious. And so this is a terrible outcome. It happens in worlds usually where human beings exist. Generally, life before human does not interfere with the beauty, we'll call it, of energy and the other kingdoms that it involves itself with. Humans get involved because they use the kingdoms, including energy, the energy kingdom, to become part of their own senses and bodies as an extension of them, to allow them to do many great things, everything from watching each other millions of miles away, or doing all kinds of amazing things, in communication thousands and thousands of miles away, lots of other stuff, and be able to travel at amazing speeds. But they do this because that's what they're supposed to do, to develop civilization, which is an extension of who they are, their bodies and senses. But if they develop themselves into ugly situations that are really toxic, eventually it kills life in general, and it kills them. And it produces a retardant to a planet's growth, which could eventually, over time, destroy the planet. And, of course, evil is the big destroyer of life, so it really gets on the bandwagon with this whole scenario that I just described. And it loves to create civilization that is usually hostile towards the demonic parts of life, of energy, excuse me, and that breaks apart the energy kingdom into mostly elemental reactions with very little intelligence. And the intelligence that is employed is strictly to become more and more destructive rather than creative. So this is the process. The energy is usually used to enslave other humans and sometimes other life forms in general. And that's the process of destruction of life on the part of evil. So we exist in this problem because Earth is not sacred and has a great deal of evil on it, and is in the process of trying to deal with the overwhelming, strong parts of evil that presently, and for a long time actually, have existed. And energy becomes the means of destruction and the means of life creation. So the misuse of energy and to develop high levels of force, especially in the physical world and some parts of the lower subworlds of the astral plane, is to destroy eventually life itself, which is the destruction, in their crazy thinking, of God, and to gain power and control over all things, especially our life, and especially human life. So this is the process that we are, we'll say, as a battle, are in. And the energy kingdom is the main, where the main battle takes place. So forces become inextricably part of the plan of evil. Now, forces could be considered good if human beings are using their consciousness to overcome the forces and to reduce them and help the demonic parts of energy to assist all parts of life, but especially the energy that is interplaying with life, so that there can be an improvement in the quality and form, quality being consciousness and form, of all life. The balance is the critical element, and humans are not very good at the present time here on Earth of balancing these things. As a matter of fact, we could be declared as being downright no good at it. So, now that doesn't mean everybody's no good at it, but it's few and far between that have even a small amount of being good at it. Okay, so, let's go now to the plant kingdom and talk about plants, what their job is, okay? The plant kingdom works hand in hand with the energy kingdom to allow that there is sufficient forms of sufficient types of forms of solid things or particleized things for other forms of life, including their own, to use from the energy kingdom. And they also change the way energy works in many different ways between the mineral kingdom and themselves and the plants, and also animals and beyond, and even to the level of the, what are called the sub-kingdom parts, which includes like fungi and bacteria and molds and viruses. All those things that we think of as being a piece of life are really part of how each separate part supports the other part. Now, I know some people say, well, what's a virus good for? You know, viruses are really not that great. You know, they usually make things sick or problematic. That's all true. And they have a very negative side, to say the least. But viruses are used in the more basic processes in creating certain kinds of cells by bringing a virus into a cell and joining its RNA with some of the DNA in the cell to make new kinds of cells. So sometimes viruses in the past especially were used that way, and they're still used sometimes that way today. And humans are starting to replicate this process in doing genetic engineering. So it isn't like we discovered it per se and are using it, but we are using it because at the same time that we did discover it, we're using it and found, oh, this is how probably cells eventually started making some changes themselves. But it's an odd thing that we think of viruses as being the bad guys, you know, or the bad, you know, they're going to do terrible things. And for the most part, they're not so bad, but some are nasty as all heck, and others are sometimes helpful. It all depends. You just got to pick your virus. But remember, a virus has, usually by definition, it doesn't have all the marbles, so to speak, to create life without stealing some from something else in life, usually it's some part of a cell, and using that to make its engineering of more parts of itself. And so it couldn't replicate without that. Bacteria on their own can replicate. So there's a, generally speaking, that's true. Some bacteria actually are virus-like. Some viruses are kind of bacteria-like. So you can't really sometimes make that clear definition, but it's a pretty close approximation. And so the plant kingdom helps all those kingdoms, including those little microscopic ones, to find the right minerals and the right composition of gases, air, some people call it, and the right composition of even climate and environment in other ways, and salts may be critical, and other kinds of basic chemicals. Plants are critical in the way they change the world around them, so that all these things are available for all kinds of life. And then, of course, everybody is going to say, well, don't they make oxygen? And isn't that important? Yes, the plants take in, by and large, most plants take in carbon dioxide and they expel oxygen. So as plants grow, there's usually more oxygen both in the medium that they're growing in and sometimes beyond it. So plants grow in the oceans. They add oxygen into the oceans, which allows some types of life, animal life in the oceans, to be able to use the oxygen dissolved in the water. Well, that's pretty important. And but some of that oxygen also escapes into the atmosphere and starts growing the atmosphere everywhere, above the oceans and on land. And eventually plants do much more. They absorb minerals from the soil that they're in, be it at the bottom of an ocean or sometimes they don't even need to be planted in soil. They could get it right out of the medium that they're in. Sometimes they get it from water. Sometimes, infrequently, they can get some minerals directly from air. And so, because there's little bits of minerals in air sometimes. And they use all this to redistribute it, so to speak, to other life forms that can't collectively bring it all together and stay alive long enough to use it. So the plants are really bringing it together. So the very first things the plants feed to animals is like gases and minerals, and sometimes also water or other fluid-like things in the water. So and that comes in from the plant itself, and each plant, and there's a huge variety of them, does something a little differently in the way that I just talked about these things. That's the reason they look different and they function differently. Most plants don't feed on animals, but some do. And, you know, it's kind of, and insects too, and acarids, and all kinds of bugs and things. They may chew on those if they are those kinds of plants. But most plants don't do that. And most plants also act as a food source over time. Now, what I mean by food? Food is mostly dense energy. So they supply not only the basic elements to structurally complete something, which includes all the basic, you know, we'll call it inorganic things, but they supply organic energies that eventually create hydrocarbons that, when reformed or recombined, produce a release of energy through an oxygen cycle. And that builds up heat. Heat is good because you need heat to make movement. And it's a whole other side to what the plants are doing. So there's this huge system that plants are participating in to add to life. And they must do this in concert with energy. If plants didn't have any, we'll call it thought behind them, too many plants of a certain kind could create an imbalance very quickly, in the world that would potentially end life even for those plants themselves. Let me give you an example. Let's say you get the most efficient kind of CO2-producing plants that you could possibly have. They're just ferocious in producing lots of CO2. And let's say they existed during the Carboniferous period of time, in that 360 million years ago, when there was a lot of coal being formed on this. And these plants were just really good at starting to use lots of CO2 and producing an awful lot of oxygen in the process. Huge amounts of oxygen. It's good, you say. Well, you get really big critters like insects and centipedes and spiders, and all kinds of big things, like giant ones, like many feet long, dragonflies, you know, wings like small airplanes, and giant, kind of, you know. That, because those things require large amounts of oxygen, because they don't have very efficient means of getting oxygen out of the air compared to more sophisticated life. And so all that's going on, well, that's great, that's wonderful. But let's say you get some plant that is so good at this that instead of producing 41 or 2% oxygen, produces 80% oxygen. Well, if you got that much oxygen in the air, truly, actually before you could get much over 50% oxygen, every time there would be a lightning strike, you'd burn up huge parts of the planet. And if in a short time, life itself, including the plants that were making all this stupid oxygen, right, because they're so efficient at taking CO2 and making a lot more oxygen with it, would kill off all life and eventually themselves. Sound impossible? No. It kind of, if you think about it in terms of pure evolution, that's what should have happened, actually. But it didn't. Okay. And so it's a strange thing that there is a balance in the dance between energy and plants and all the other kingdoms, too, to maintain a parameter of what's called chemistry and physics and basic life conditions that allows for, instead of, as evolution would dictate, the strongest, the fittest, becoming the dominant, eventually, if you take it to its logical conclusion, the only life, to which means no life would exist, because all life is interdependent upon other life. Instead, you have more and more specialization, more and more, we'll call it distinct and unusual types of life. And that's the amazing thing about it. And mutations are welcome rather than killed off, which shouldn't work if you believe totally in evolution. And so you get into this really strange thing that it becomes a almost the model for explaining why the energy kingdom does exist the way I described it, because it is doing part of the job. You see what it's doing? It's diversifying life in the way that it's making or helping to make plants work with it. And it's a fascinating situation, and plants are doing exactly the same thing. You should be aware of why the plants change. Well, they change the environment, and as the environment changes, they change with it. And the energy kingdom has changed, and the sun is changing. That's another thing you may not be aware of. And the moon is changing its position in relationship to the earth, and the tidal currents are moving differently, and all kinds of other stuff are happening. All these changes are like a dance, and they all move in a direction of creating a kind of stronger, more diverse life over time. Now, there are periods of time when this isn't necessarily true, and some people will say, aha, what about when Earth became a snowball? And aha, what about when Earth had this catastrophe or that catastrophe? Well, those kinds of things happen because they're the control mechanism. When too much of one kind of life is starting to imbalance the system, that life is squelched. Sometimes it's almost extinguished. And so other kinds of more specialized life can take advantage of the niches that are created during these supposed crises that take place. You have to look deeper into the equation to see the whole thing. And so plants participated in this in strange ways. Yeah, we're almost sure of, that the Earth became a big snowball, which means it was just covered with miles of ice everywhere. You can't really say there are very many plants growing around, right? Most of life became submerged in the soil below the level of the ice. And the life that was there, if we call it plants, was completely devoid of light, which was a critical source of energy. We haven't even gotten to the sun yet, but it's a critical source of energy for many kinds of plants. And some other kinds of life managed to survive, partly because some of the energy that was created by the snow itself and the ice is gravity and pushes the earth down so that it heats up. And some of these things could live in parts of the earth that they can't live in now because they don't exist anymore. They created crevices and places where there was natural energy, heat available, but no light. And there's many forms of life that still exist in the oceans today that live off of heat but no light. And most of the life that we know of on the planet came from those kinds of life forms eventually, because that part of life was what sustained and continued the life cycle during these unusual periods of hundreds of millions of years of being covered in ice. Why would that be so important? Why would you want to do that if you were creating life? Why not just have life that wonderfully lives no matter what? Well, it does something that's strange. The life that has such extreme crisis doesn't lose necessarily all of the DNA and all of the knowledge, we'll call it, of life before it. It holds on to it, but it doesn't use it anymore for a while, maybe 100 million years, like. And instead, it finds new, unique ways to live, which become morphed in a way as the conditions become more hospitable for life, when the sun changes its energy output, the moon moves further away from Earth, and certain other things change just enough so that all of the issues that cause the freezing disappear. Or it could be heating in some circumstances. But all of these things have a role to play in the use of how energy is diversifying life. So over time, although life could be killed off, it isn't, because the plan of this whole situation is to really strengthen life, not weaken it, but also to get rid of life that might destroy the world by becoming too prolific. Is that hard to believe? There, at one point, there was a type of bacteria that 99.9% of the planet's life was that bacteria. Now, it sounds hard to believe because we don't think of bacteria being all that big of a deal, but it was a big deal then. And we still find the mounds and the tidal beds that had it. But as the moon moved away, the tidal pools changed, and that life found it difficult to exist. But also the freezing cold stopped it. Bacteria could have ended life on Earth by being too successful. And there had to be a counter to it, so that ultimately, no matter what the conditions were in the future, this could never happen again. So that it's sort of like making life one step at a time more and more adaptable and more capable of growing closer to its own creator, which means that it is eventually creating its own diversity, not because of outside events, but eventually from inner choices. Now, you might say, well, inner choices? Well, yeah. How are you going to get to the point where there any kind of life which we would call it to be significantly intelligent? That means that more and more of the divine energy is being used in life, and less of it is being controlled by the elementary element of energy. And so those are the things that really play on this whole scenario. They make it so that ultimately energy becomes a prominent part of how, in this case, plants move and choose to change. And eventually you could call it native intelligence. The native intelligence is built up by each diversity of change, which sometimes comes from catastrophe, sometimes from great, we'll call it, advantages that the life itself helps to create, as well as the environment. And all together, it's all moving in one direction, towards its own creator, by starting to replicate some parts of the creator, by being creative itself. Now, we don't think of a plant being very creative, but actually plants are quite creative and quite adaptable. And they show a lot of intelligence in numerous ways, if you study them. And the thing that's amazing about plants is some of them actually move fairly quickly, considering they're not really considered animated life. Yet, they can move fairly rapidly, and all plants can move some to some degree. They can't get up and walk away, but they certainly can move in various ways based upon where the sun is, where certain elements exist, and all kinds of stuff. And it's it's just amazing that they have these senses that do permit that to take place, even though they move in a much generally slower way on average than animated life or animals do or people. But they still are able to do this to some extent, and this is the part that's fascinating. Movement means energy. And energy that employs movement that helps to grow life is called intelligent movement. And the more of that that takes place means that more divonic energies are being employed than elementary energies. Some of those divonic energies themselves are beings. That's why we call the energy kingdom a kingdom, because it has being in it. A divonic energy being is usually found in the physical world in the electromagnetic part or etheric parts. And those parts means that they're mostly wave energy. Do they have any solid form? Not really, because we can walk right through them and they can walk right through us, so to speak. Although they try to avoid people. They actually can move and they will avoid people. In folklore, they've been sometimes given names like fairies and this and that, elves. That's the anthropomorphic explanation of divonic energy. There's some truth to some of the ways that these explanations try to describe these divonic beings, but they are far from, oftentimes, what has been invented by humans to describe them. Just because they are far from it, that doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that they are more complicated, and they aren't so anthropomorphized human-like. As a matter of fact, they're quite non-human-like. And that's probably why we have such a hard time with them, because to really understand something that's different from oneself, you have to have a really open mind and be a good observer and have great senses to be observing, or some kind of technology to improve your senses to observe. And we haven't done any of those things very well in terms of the divonic parts of etheric beings. And it goes into the astral world as well, so it isn't just there. So these beings attempt to help plants to communicate with one another by communicating through the soul, which is always a group soul when we're dealing with plants, of the species and subspecies and, you know, families, species, etc., of various plants. And they're specific to sometimes just a very, very, very narrow range of subspecies of plants, because plants are so specialized, there's lots of different kinds. And they may have a lot of different kinds, therefore, of divonic energies helping them. The divonic energies can be cooperatively worked with if you know how to do that. They are attracted to beauty, and beauty is a very strong vibrational, Buddhic vibrational or intuitional plane vibrational effect on sense, that allows the sense to respond to light more effectively and to darkness and to what we'll call squalor and a lack of coordination, which we'll call darkness and evil. So beauty is the opposite of those things, and divonic energies are attracted to beauty and they leave areas that do not have those qualities of beauty. And if there's a lot of darkness and ugliness and disorganization, you'll find very few divonic energies available. That means that plants have a trouble surviving there. And it also means that the plant kingdom is retarded in its growth as humans create ugly environments. That's a tough one to believe for some people.
Well, I don't care what, if something's ugly or not ugly, you should be able to plant something and grow just the same.
Well, why don't you try that experiment sometime and see what you come up with? I've done it, and I noticed the difference. You should do it, too. plant some plants in a very ugly place, but make sure that all other things are equal, if you can't make them that way, and then in a very beautiful place and see which plants thrive. So diphonic energies have this peculiar, peculiar nature to them, that they basically are more than just conditioned by the environment to move away. They actually make the choice and will even become more adamant to help destroy life, in a sense, by not cooperating, because they want to punish humans, and mostly humans, who create ugliness by reducing the benefit of plants to that particular environment. Now, that's a little bit for some people to swallow. I know some people find out, oh, that can't be true. But it is true. And so this is something for all of us to take pause with, because it has a lot of connotations to it and a lot of significant elements. So these energy beings are so intertwined with plants that they actually sometimes get ticked off at humans for being ugly and want to reduce the pleasantness of the human experience by further reducing the life around them. Now, there's another thing to this that you should know about. When you remove the positive parts of life, there's negative parts that say, oh boy, and they come running in. Some of those negative parts include diseases and nasty ones of that, and decomposing kinds of things, and certain kinds of nasty insects and other creatures of the kind. A lot of people will say, well, it brings about rats, probably. Well, yeah, rats are kind of like, they kind of dig the uglier parts of the world. You don't find them too much around the beautiful parts. And so you find it is a kind of a cacophony of negative energy life that moves in, that doesn't respond to divonic energies, but responds actually to the dark energies, which includes destroyed or being destroyed elemental energies, and beings actually that are composed more of elemental energies that are sort of the opposite of the divonic energies. Oh, this sounds like some kind of movie or something, right? No, it can't be true, can it? Yeah, it is, but you got to really, really have an open mind to even listen to what I'm explaining, because it sounds like, oh, it's something I read about. It's a fairy tale, right? It's not a fairy. It's energy. And the interplay with plants is peculiar. Now, a lot of people say, well, isn't that true for animals? I mean, animals have spirit, right? And the spirit is connected through this energy factor, so the spirit and the energy are working together. So there's some kind of energy that's involved with animals, too. Isn't that sort of divonic? And yes, there is. And there's a spirit involved. Plants collectively have spirit, but not so much individuals. And very few plants have individual spirit connected to them. But they have a closer bond with the divonic energies than animals have with the spirit side of their existence. And the reason for that is that the plants themselves have a common goal, unlike animals or people, to try to cause life to grow. Animals try to cause their own kind of life to grow, sometimes, and their own specific life to stay alive. But plants will sacrifice some of themselves to grow other plants, and plants will, beyond that, collectively work together. I have done an experiment, we're doing experiments in the yard here, proving this. The plants that grow at the same height of other plants to shelter them, grow at the height that the plants need to be sheltered at. And they're the plants that are attracted to them. And the other plants that have to grow higher because they're protecting even taller and bigger, we'll call trees. We have flowers that are doing the sheltering, some kinds of flowers. And it's amazing that it's consistent as you look through this area that this is what's happening. There's no explanation for it except that it's divinic. That they're getting communication, which plants grow where and how tall they grow. Some of them are the same, coming from the same kinds of seeds. They're all actually spread out together. And yet some grew much taller, others grow not so tall. And it isn't the reverse. It isn't where the tree is sheltering the plant. That you could probably explain how tall a plant is because it's got to grow taller to get the sun, etc. But this is the reverse. This is the opposite of that. And there's no way to explain that in terms of just, well, it's just responding to light. No, it's not responding to light. It's responding to the other plants that it's protecting. They're working together. And then you look at the insects that are working with the plants, and the birds working with plants and the insects, and it's a pretty amazing system. And again, a lot of this is divonic, and it's coming because collectively, the whole place is beautiful. If it were ugly, you would have the reverse happen, and then it would be going in the opposite direction. Actually, the tree would kill off the plants, and you would have a totally different kind of relationship. And these are new trees, young trees, that have to have some kind of protection. And the plants are attempting to do that. And we put some covers over them, but it gets up to 115 degrees and the sun's baking them. Yeah, everything in Arizona here needs that kind of stuff once in a while. Or sometimes parts of the year is the best way to put it. But excluding that aspect, the divinic beings are doing their job. Now, how come they can't protect a plant when it's 115 degrees and the sun is 160, 165 degrees baking on the plant? And there's a reason for that. The group soul of the plant was developed in an environment outside of Phoenix, Arizona. And that group soul, it works great in some parts of Texas or other parts of the country. It marginally can work here, but it can't work based upon what its understandings are in communication with the divinic energies to keep the plant alive when it reaches 165 degrees in full sunlight at noon or 1 or 2 in the afternoon. So that's the problem. It isn't the plant's fault. And it's not the group soul's fault, it's the human beings who decided to grow those plants in an environment that's so difficult. So we have to supply some of the help to make sure that they stay alive. And that's very important. Now what happens if we don't do that? Let's say we plant them and we say, you know, heck, let the divinic energies take care of it or whatever. I'm not going to try to cover them when it gets so hot, and I'm not going to try to, you know, spray them down or keep them cool or whatever. They'll just have to survive or die, you know. Well, amazingly, every plant that dies causes a negative feedback loop to the remaining divinic energies, and before long, you'll have plants dying wholesale, going bye-bye very quickly. You can lose the whole thing in a few days to a week or two. Even though it would seem unreasonable that many plants would die, but they will because you're chasing away, because your own selfishness, you planted these plants and now you're not willing to take care of them, you've driven away the very energies that need to be there to keep things alive. And part of these energies also work to adjust the chemistry of the soil and keep moisture in the soil as best as they can and do a lot of other things that are remarkable. Part of it is ground cover. They'll keep some things low to the ground that can grow there to keep moisture in the ground and to keep some cooling going through transpiration when it does get super hot. It's a pretty remarkable system. And they're working together. They're not separate. They're not alone. they're working together. You don't think so? Gotta see it. Now, I know this may be, you know, just happening here by some magic or something. But I've seen this every place I go, so it isn't just here. I'm just using this particular example because obviously I'm more familiar with it. The interesting thing is that when we look at how the whole system works, it's the energy kingdom that is in the forefront. But it can't, you can't say, well, the energy kingdom would die. It wouldn't necessarily die if plants didn't cooperate. But there wouldn't be more life, and energy wouldn't advance life and become more intelligent in its activity unless the plants were interplaying together and the divinic energies weren't helping the plants and the souls weren't working with the divinic energies. Well, I'll tell you more about that in a couple of minutes here, but I think we'll take a little bit of a break because I know I've said so much in such a short time that some people are probably going, you know, is he ever going to stop talking? You know, I mean, tell us something else. So I think I will. We'll take a little bit of a break, and let me tell you that, again, I'll remind you that there's a Life's Hidden Meaning. That's a textbook I wrote that's really big, you know, study group forming. And it's going to be taught by me, right? I'm going to teach this particular group. And it's free to study Ageless Wisdom. It'll be on Wednesday evenings, starting in September. I'll give you the date on that, from 7 to 9 p.m. Arizona time. Now, Arizona's kind of a little strange. We don't go on daylight savings time. Most of the rest of the country, even the world, goes on daylight savings time these days, but we don't. And is that a big deal? Well, for us, it's a big deal because we don't want more sun. It's okay for it to come up early and set early for us. But for the rest of the world, they like more sun. So for like 8-9 months of the year, they prefer having the sun be up more. And so they go on daylight savings time, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It actually saves a little bit of electricity, 1 or 2%, so for some places. So you can understand why we do that, but at the same time, remember that 7 o'clock here is the equivalent of Pacific time for 8.5 months of the year. And that's the weird thing about it. And since this group is going to be going for at least a year, that will just change the wrinkle by an hour for some people, and you might have to adjust that for yourselves depending upon where you live. If the date we're going to start will be September 4th, this coming September 4th, and that's the official kickoff time. There's going to be the opportunity to participate, not just to listen in if you're not physically. And about half or more of the people in this particular study group, it's going to be pretty big. It might be 30 people or more in it. But half or more of them will be listening over either a phone line, which is option one, we'll call it, or over the internet using, internet connecting source, which means you'll be able to see what's going on as well as listen and speak. That'll be like option two for those folks. And we're getting all kinds of different equipment together to make this as good an experience as possible so that people will be able to see good and hear good, even hear the people that are there in the room and over all of the different lines all at the same time. It's pretty hard to combine all these technologies, but we've figured out a way to make me think on how to do it. Okay, so that's how... where and how and when. And I will be teaching this, and it will be every week from 7 to 9 p.m. on Wednesday evening starting on September 4th. And the way you sign up is you can contact us at thoughts@whylifeis.com, thoughts@whylifeis.com, and the at is the aspirin sign, whylifeis.com, and or you can call this phone number, which is 800-777-7850. And that's 800-777-7850. And all you have to do is say, gee, I'd like to sign up. Or if you want to just get more information, hey, you can do that too, or find out anything you want about it, and that's great. You will need to have a copy that you can read of Life's in Meaning. And we'll look at it about 2 pages a day, 14 pages a week, that we're going to cover on an average. Now, some weeks it might be slightly more or slightly less, depending upon what I think of the material in terms of its difficulty. But it's going to be an average of that. Most people can actually handle about 2 pages of that, even though that's a hard book, but 2 pages is probably not too much. And so that's, I think, the pace we're going to be going at. It's about a year. It'll at least be a year, I'll tell you that. And it may be a month past that or so. We don't know for sure, because it's going to be up to how the group proceeds. We're going to meet on every Wednesday, unless Wednesday turns out to be some kind of holiday, and then we'll maybe rearrange that week or something or figure out some other way of doing it. Okay, so we're going to go back now to our show tonight and talk about, again, the interrelationship of the energy in plant kingdoms. And I was talking about the souls and how they relate to the divinic energies. And this is a little hard for most people to gather. You know, like, where the heck is a plant soul? A plant soul is found in the following position. It's on the third sub-plane of the third plane, the third sub-plane of the mental world. So it's a very, 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 very small section is where you find these places where the group souls like to hang around, so to speak, of plants. Now, are plant group souls really active? Yes, they have a basic level of what would be considered to be intelligence. Remember, intelligent activity is what attracts. Intelligent thought is what attracts divinic energies. They're very attracted to it. So they're looking for their level of what they can function at in terms of being able to communicate and interact between the plant, which is here in the physical world. Sometimes we're dealing with plants in the astral world, by the way, too, and the group soul. Now, why do they want to communicate with the group soul? Well, the group soul is the part of the plant that is what we would call instincts in animals. But plants actually have the same kind of thing. They're informed by the group soul of how they should respond to the environment in the most intelligent way possible. And it's where most of the intelligence that plants have come from. Now, that means that plants don't have, like, nervous systems and brains. They're using predominantly a system of a group soul working through and communicating to the divinic energy, which then communicates to the plant directly. How does the divinic energy communicate with the plant? We got, again, communicating with the group soul is not that hard to figure out. I mean, the group soul is highly intelligent in comparison to the plant, and the divinic energy is trying to become like as intelligent as the group soul. Then the group soul is composed of about half spirit, right, and half energy itself. And it's got a good balance on that spirit and energy in terms of a group of kinds of plants. For that specific group of plants, it's pretty good in its intelligence. The divinic energy wants to become more intelligent in its activity. That's like God. It's attracted to God and God's mind. And it wants to become like the group soul. So it's sort of being informed by spirit, you would say. And then when it goes back to the plant, this is the part that's a little hard for some people to gather. It affects the elementary energy that's in the plant and a little bit of demonic energy that also is in the plant, but not very much. So most of there's a little bit of energy that is called the more rudimentary demonic energies. They are the youngest version. They're usually etheric. but they're lower than the first and second and third etheric or super etheric forms, and then usually in the lowest part of the etheric plane, which is called the fourth subplane of the etheric plane. And these divinic energies are found oftentimes in this super etheric part. So they're higher. They're higher in consciousness, higher in energy versus form. And they can't directly go inside the plant the way the energy, the small amount of divinic energy that is actually inside the plant can. That energy actually moves in the plant itself and helps the chemistry of the plant move and fluids to move in the plant, all kinds of good things. So might as the clothes are open and different parts of the plant to change them out. But the super etheric parts, the parts of the divinic energies that are outside the plant, they are in communication with the root soul and trying to communicate with the divinic parts of the plant that are inside the plant, and they can do so. They act as a bridge, you might say. And they're pretty effective at doing this. They actually can affect not one plant, but a whole bunch of a host of plants of similar kind. And the other thing that they can do, which is really fascinating, is they communicate with a lot of other super etheric divinic energy beings that work with different kinds of plants. So they actually can work together. Ah, now we go back to that thing with the flowers protecting the little trees. You can see how that works, because the super etheric divinic energies that are helping the flowers are communicating with the divinic energies that are working on the trees. And that's how the whole thing fits together. I'm trying to make it simple. It's a little more complicated when you get to hundreds of different kinds of plants and interacting with even some kinds of low levels of animal life, including insects. So you get a lot more involved than what I'm saying. But nonetheless, this is the basics of how the system works. And it is truly a beautiful thing when it's working in harmony together. It's like a grand symphony of music. And every piece has its role to play. And it's all working at the same time. And when it happens correctly, things become immensely beautiful to us and to other creatures. As a matter of fact, there's some belief, and probably true, that some birds and some insects are more responsive to beauty than humans are on an average. Now, that doesn't put us in the best light, I guess, but it does explain some problems we might have. At any rate, so what else should we know about the divinic energies? Well, they not only communicate with each other, but they have an effect on people, the auras of people. Now, divinic beings don't like people very much because we as a collective right now are doing more harm than good. But once they get used to the aura of a person who is helping a plant, let's say you go out and you water the plants every day and talk to them and play them music or just enjoy them. Enjoyment, believe it or not, is a major factor here. I'll get into that in a little bit. I hope we have enough time for all this. But so you're in there, in that environment. How does that relate to the aura and everything? The divinic energies, if they're super etheric, have a slight effect on the second and even into the first etheric subparts of anything around them because of what is the sympathetic vibration. So they sympathetically affect our first etheric nature, which is the highest part of the etheric plane. And that's where a good deal of our etheric brain exists in, and where our etheric nervous system exists in. And it has a peculiar effect on improving the senses in a human being first, and then the overall health of all the systems in a human being. So if you want to make somebody more well, and maybe they're not so well, if you can get them to respond properly in an environment with plants in it, plants become a healing source. I know this sounds crazy. Some people are going to say, oh, this guy is really flipped, you know. It's true. I'm trying to tell you the truth because I've seen this happen many times, but you got to go test these theories. You don't just believe me, but go out and try it. It becomes a healing source for people who need it, provided that they have beauty as an experience, their own senses are improved, and they're willing to give back to the plants in some way, even if it's just to admire them. Believe it or not, that affects the plants because it affects the divine energies that are serving them. When you appreciate the plants by expressing it in yourself, which is how you feel, okay, that sentiment affects the divine beings, and they become more attentive to improving the plants because they're getting more and more closer to the intelligent action with the group soul of the plants. It all works together. Now, one thing that doesn't happen, some people believe this otherwise, but I'm going to tell you what I think, is our souls are not directly connected to the group souls of the plants. Now, a lot of people think that we are. But our souls are really in such a different location in the mental world that they really can't communicate with the group souls directly of plants, or vice versa, by the way. So that's not going to happen except in rare circumstances where people have what is known as a built bridge. It's called an antakarana. And you got to have a really built up good, so the three sections are all connected together. And then you actually can directly connect and have direct connection with plants and animals and other things. But that's a rare thing, and people that can do that seldom do, because you have to be extremely careful that you're not going to introduce something foul in the situation. And it's easy to have foul problems, because if you're living in a city and you know, with a lot of stresses or anything like that, you could upset the balance. So you don't want to do that unless you are equal to or better than the divinic energies and the plants themselves and the group souls of those plants are functioning together. Or else you may actually screw them up rather than help them if you have the ability to be directly in contact. Of course, if you have that ability, you're going to be very careful in using it and probably not use it very often. Because if you're serving in the physical form, it's difficult not to get beat up and screwed around with and messed up. Even if you're the most advanced, you're going to be affected. Masters, beyond in the fifth kingdom, beyond human, have problems with this if they take physical form. So the idea that you could just go in and say, well, I'll just go and tune up all the plants and all the animals and make them all wonderful. Well, except in the etheric world where the masters can do this without interference from the physical consequences of physical effects, they don't. And so the idea that human beings can do this is kind of absurd, except under the rarest of circumstances. But anyway, again, too much to talk about and not enough time to get into all these little interesting ideas and thoughts. All right, back to the interrelationship idea. So we have an effect on the divonic energies, but we don't directly affect and we don't want to directly affect the group souls. And so we work with the divonic beings if we understand them. And the best way to work with them is let them take the lead. Never try to lead divonic energies or force them to do anything. Because if you do, it gets back to the same problem with the group soul thing. And the chances are you're going to get a severe headache or some other bad consequence, and you're not going to do any good for them at all. I've experimented with this with very bad results. So I can suggest that you don't mess with it. I kind of knew it beforehand, but I wanted to be certain, so I went ahead and tried, you know. And that was a bad thing, because it didn't turn out, well, it turned out exactly as I thought it should, but it wasn't the best experiences. So at any rate, here is a good thing to experience. A good way to look at the situation. The divinic beings are really more advanced at what they're actually doing than we are. We don't have any direct sense of the super etheric part of the etheric world, do we? If you do, let me know. I mean, it's very, very difficult for us to be able to function in any competent manner. The best thing is appreciation and love. If you have appreciation and love and gratitude, those kinds of reactions and sentiment, along with the expression in terms of all activities that you do around and with the plants, all come together to produce a beneficial thing. What kind of activities? Get rid of the dead plants. Clean up the mess. Make everything as beautiful as possible. Make sure everything is living as good as possible. Fertilize if that seems appropriate. Whatever you know that is best for the plants and that they seem to need at the time will help. The more you do that, the more the plants prosper, and the more your aura becomes improved by the presence of the divinic energies. Now, how much can divinic energies do to change the aura? This is going to scare you, maybe. It scared me when I found out the negative side of it. They could kill you if they wanted to, and they can tremendously improve your aura to the point where they can cure diseases that are incurable by our standards. Now, I know that sounds like hyperbole or something. Oh, yeah, I'm going to go stand in the garden and get cured of my cancer. Well, actually, it's possible, but not likely. Why is it not likely? Because most people that are ill because they don't have a good balance in their system. They don't have the right senses. They don't even maybe react well to beauty. And maybe they're very selfish and very, you know, ugly in some respects. If that's the case, just putting them in some beautiful place is not going to really make much difference. It may make it worse. But if it's someone who maybe started off that way, but could move their consciousness in the right direction, maybe hear tonight's show and start really taking some of the stuff I say as possible and serious, maybe in a relatively short time, a few months, they might be really able to gain from this experience as I'm describing it and be improved from divinic energies. A lot of people have heard of feng shui. You know, what the heck is feng shui? Well, is it real? Yes, of course it's real. And it has to do with another kind of energy, which is called qi. And qi, by the way, I'm going to get into this, I hope, tonight. Qi has a direct relationship to divinic energy. And I'll explain how those work together in a minute. But I just want to mention feng shui for a second. There's just so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in. That feng shui is really the ability to stay in a healthier, better way, improving your senses by making sure that the qi energy, which is this kind of life energy that really comes from the spiritual plane, the atmic plane, but it goes all the way into the physical earth and comes back out again. That qi energy, along with pranic energy coming from the sun, is what keeps us alive. And it needs to be moving. The qi energy needs to be moving through us, where the pranic energy needs to be stored. It's a weird system, like storage and movement, sort of like that. But anyway, that's what you got to do. And if the qi energy stops moving, the result is that it produces destruction and illness, and it damages the aura. Now, let me explain the relationship of that to the divinic energies and how they help our auras. Divinic energies first of all, they can immediately sense all of the qi that is in a plant or in a person. In a plant, they keep the qi moving. Remember, there's some divinic energy that's in the plant that's helping things to move. And then you have the super etheric divinic beings that are more advanced that are on the outside of the plant communicating with the plant's group soul that is helping the qi to keep moving from the ground in through the plant and then out again. And then the plant absorbs prana from the sun, and if it's a sun-loving plant, which most plants are, and it takes that prana and it uses some of the prana to eventually build sugars, and some of its overall energy development is done by a process called photosynthesis in most plants. And the photosynthesis converts the sunlight into physical and etheric energy. The etheric energy goes back into the divinic energies that are inside of it, and then when it expels some of the etheric energy out with the gas of what we call oxygen, it mixes with the divinic, super etheric divinic energies that are outside the plant, building them up. At the same time, The divinic energies do a little bit of this with our auras. If our auras are in sync with the plant by appreciating and loving and finding beautiful and by syncing our senses with the plant that is beautiful, when we sync our senses with it, it attracts by the syncing the divinic energies that are super etheric to our auras. And then they, in turn, change our auras to become more accepting, which is our etheric body, we'll call it, more accepting, especially the centers of our etheric body, of the chi, so it is more in movement. Also, if we're exposed to sunlight, we use the sunlight to help our energies to grow more, but not to necessarily move more. Actually, the growing of our energies stops some movement because you're densifying it in form. So it improves the strength of growth in the body, the prana. The prana comes from two sources. It comes from the sun and from what we call food. And it's mixed together and it provides growth. Food without solar prana produces eventually a negative effect because you can't keep the energy in balance in the body and eventually you can die without prana. It takes months, but it can kill you. It certainly leads first to a condition called SAD, which is a seasonal affective disorder where you don't have enough sunlight and it actually affects the brain and changes brain chemistry. Serotonin levels go down, all kinds of bad things start happening, but then eventually affects the whole body. So if you don't live in any sunlight, you could be in serious trouble within months or a year or so. Okay, so back to the situation now. Say too much too fast, aren't I? Are you following me? I hope you are. Okay. So the super etheric beings actually are attempting by their attraction to the beauty of our matching senses to the senses of sensing the beauty in the plants. They become attracted to us, and they help the chi to move through our body and not become trapped. When it becomes trapped in minor centers, and especially in major centers, the chi becomes illness, and eventually it kills us. That's trapped chi. The feng shui concept is to keep the chi moving by the environment around us, not just in terms of plants, but in terms of the balance of all things. Because plants are only part of it. What about minerals? What about chairs and and tables and all kinds of things actually are involved in that. So anything that is beautiful that we can call beauty affects the way energy moves in our bodies. But plants are more important in reality than whether you put your couch on one side of the room or the other. But it all comes together. And if you use every part of these concepts, they actually additively can improve your health and make you into your senses into much better senses. Okay, so the super etheric divinic energies become very attracted to us while we're surrounded by the plants and having appreciation for them and finding that they're beautiful because we become more beautiful in the process. One becomes the other. The super etheric beings then enter our aura. Now this sounds a little weird. Okay, they enter our aura. It's not a sexual kind of thing or anything like that. And when they enter the aura, they become interlaced, you might say, with the chi energy and pranas that we have inside of us. They start making them work better by balancing them. They use some of their energy to counterbalance the negative chi and the negative prana to produce a healthier body, and the auric color of us will change, or energies of us will change, and the result is health over time can be reestablished. And does it help to eat the right things and do all these other things that, you know, are things I've talked about in many other programs? Sure, absolutely. But what really helps is to eat the right plants, because the plants also are the etheric energies in the plant. Remember, the demonic energy in the plant is the fourth etheric, and that's, we eat a lot of that stuff, okay? And that energy, some of it goes all the way to the first etheric subplate. Those energies are what we call herbs, and they are things that are super nutrients to us because they allow the energies to work with the super etheric beings and also with our auras in general, and for us to get better. The best thing is to eat the right herbal sources for if you're ill, to counter the effects in your body, and then go into a beautiful place with lots of plants and many other things that are beautiful, and the effects will be a more profound level of what we call health and cure and improvement in sense overall. Now, I'm going very fast here because this is a huge subject to cover in a very short period of time, but hopefully this is starting to make some practical sense to those out there that are hearing this. Okay. Now, how practical is this? I mean, is this really like a big deal? Compared to allopathic medicine, this is like 1,000 times more helpful than most everything in allopathy. Allopathic medicine generally does the opposite over the long run of the things I'm saying. I talk about medicine now. I'm not talking about medical practice, which may involve things that are different than the use of medicines, which includes pharmaceuticals usually. And that allopathic approach is mostly toxic, and it reduces the qi levels in most people. And it imbalances chronic responses so that you get all kinds of indigestional issues. You can't see the if you wreck the relationship of the solar prana with the food, the prana and the food, you get terrible bad upsets in your system, including the organisms that help us to digest and do things are killed off or imbalanced. And it's a bad, bad set of things go goofy. All right. So this is way better than that. And it is easy, relatively, to do. May not cost anything or cost very little if you think about the relative cost of herbs compared to most pharmaceuticals. Even over-the-counter, which is the cheapest form of pharmaceutical stuff, is still not that cheap. And even if it is cheap, the things that it does to you is usually not all that helpful. I'm not saying you shouldn't take us some things that are over-the-counter or some things that even are prescription. Yes, those things can temporarily, on a short-term basis, do something that's really out of balance, a change. And it may be just what you need for 3 days, 5 days, 10 days, at most maybe. But the point is that you're going to pay for it in other things that will get out of balance, and you should try to mitigate the effects of those elements by including herbal factors if you're going to go down that road. And you better know what you're doing if you're going to go down that road, because you can do a lot more harm than good. Even if you're going to a doctor, they don't know what they're talking about. I mean, an allopathic doctor, they don't know any of this other stuff that I'm talking about. And if they did, they probably would think it's crazy anyway. So here's the point. The object is to, as much as possible, use what I'm explaining to you tonight because it's of such great benefit. Improves senses, even if you don't think you have any diseases that need immediate treatment. The improvement in sense increases life expectancy. From accidents, from diseases, from aging. So if you don't want to age, all of these things are improved by everything that we're dealing with this evening. Amazing. Now, what kind of plants do you want to consume and under what basis? Well, that's a little complicated. I've invented this thing called Fai Chi, which is a science, that went through and looked at all the different herbs, and a lot of them, and that are especially ones commonly used, and how they affect the qi in different ways using energy values based on the rays to allow a person to alter their, we'll call it, centers and the qi and prana in their centers, particularly the qi, and to allow the qi to move more freely in a more balanced way. Also to deal with the possibility, therefore, of you some of these other parts of changing the relationship. Plants give us many options. And so, you know, if you're going to use other methods of manipulation of the etheric body, some people use these things, Reiki, this and that, and all this. Those kinds of things are good, but they usually need a lot more of the other things I'm talking about, especially if you can get plants and super etheric beings, you know, demonic beings, to be of assistance. You can make huge amounts of improvements in your overall well-being. You've got to try it, though, and work with it. Practice is required because most people have damaged their senses so far, they don't immediately respond to beauty or life itself, and it takes literally some adjustment to get back to what would be considered a normal state for human beings, which is to respond to those things properly. Remember, though, this. If you go with antipathy and a wrong attitude in general about the plants and divine energies, you become their enemy, and they can do the reverse of everything that I have said. This is sort of like the caution on old bottles, you know, to read about. Well, be aware that this is not a one-way street. You have to go in there with the love to give to the plants and the divinic energies in the plants and outside and the group souls. Or if you don't, you could encounter the absolute reverse of what I'm saying. You could accelerate the aging, the loss of sense, and illness tremendously, actually. So if you have any kind of really negative problems, don't go in and say, well, gee, I want these plants to do something for me, and they better do it right now, or else I'll go mow them down or something. That's going to produce some very bad effects. And it could even be fatal to some people who are already ill. So don't just wantonly say, hey, I heard this guy on the radio. All you got to do is just go down there to that garden over there, and you'll be just fine. Just hang out there. Well, I know you really hate him, but so what? Just chop down a few plants and tell them they better do what you want. That kind of thing will lead to really bad results. Even the desire to communicate, this is where I come in, huh? I tried this, communicate with these divinic energies. They are powerful. Some of them, especially for trees, and they're big trees, are powerful beings. They stand around the plants, you know, they can be 200 feet tall and 50 to 100 feet wide. They're huge. And you don't want to mess around with them by saying, hey, let's why don't we have a game of golf? Or how about you and I just chill out for a while? You know, I want to get to know you. Or maybe I can study you while you're doing your thing. That is all going to lead to some very serious consequences. And even if you think you have good intentions, like, oh, I'll share all my knowledge with all other people so they'll be nice to plants too. That's not good enough. The immediate effect on what's happening is what the demonic energies respond to, not like, well, gee, if you just let me hang out for a week, I'll try and do something for you. It's just not going to work with these things. They don't respond that way. They are immediately either attracted or repelled by a person's aura and what's in their heart and mind and what their senses are doing. They immediately respond to that. I mean, it's just you can't, it's not a negotiation, although I thought it was at one time. I learned otherwise. So you've got to basically be in the right place to be there, or you shouldn't be messing around with it. Does that mean you shouldn't go into nice places and beautiful places, even if you're in a bad mood? You can do that, but don't have the expectation of trying to be changed because the expectation attracts their attention, good or bad. So don't have the expectations. It's okay to go to beautiful places that are nice, even if you're in a bad mood, but just don't go there and say, I'm going there to get better, because I know what this guy said on the radio, and these demonic energies are going to just help me out, because you're going to get probably clobbered. And something bad may happen, may get sicker. If you feel weaker, it just may not work out the way you'd like it to. So, again, selfishness doesn't work. There's nothing more repugnant to a demonic being that's working with its group souls and its plants to have a human being come in and interfere by having a self-focused attitude. It just screws up them, it screws up their plants, and they react badly. And remember, they have power. They have power to help, but they can also, if they see you as a negative thing, they will do something negative. Okay. And then people will say, oh, well, there was nothing but dark energies there anyway. And they're not dark, they're just responding to you, and if you're in a bad place, you could get bad stuff back to you. Okay. You gotta really get beyond your own misery if you really want to be helped by these things, is the answer. So, don't say, well, misery loves company and I'll just go. No, it doesn't love their company, and they don't love you if you come in with that attitude. Okay. So let's cover now how plants respond to the demonic energies so that the system, we can see the closed loop of this system. The better the demonic energies, the stronger the, and the outside, the super etheric and the group soul's responses to them, the better the plants produce internally etheric energies, which are demonic, that produce healthy food and herbs. Now, herbs are the things that do something besides just feed us in terms of energies. They move energies in us and correct problems. So the plants do this because they are, we'll say, well-served. If they are well-served by the surrounding super-etheric demonic beings and by the group souls, then they have the ability to literally produce some incredible food for all other kinds of life. And that's the kind of food you want to eat, because that food may be 2, 3, 4 times more nutritious than what you normally eat. May have little or no negative energy in it, which is good. Also, most people know this, if you eat plants that are fed chemicals, like chemicals that are very similar to the pharmaceuticals I was talking about that people take, then they can't make the kind of herbal energies or food that is good for us. So be aware of that. You don't want to eat plants that are fed things that are artificial of sorts, because they will destroy our senses in our bodies and make us ill over time and will age faster. You can see why that would be true now that we know more about how the energy kingdom and plant kingdoms are working together. So some of this is starting, I hope, to like, oh, yeah, I can start seeing how it all fits together. It does fit together. Then the other part of this equation now is the herbal part. The herbs of plants are special. Not all plants can really make strong herbal things, herbal compounds, because they may be more food plants, or they may be, in some respects, not specialized along that ray focus, which usually is called fourth ray focus. Now, super etheric beings that respond to the fourth ray of focus have a very special kind of nature to them. They are more delicate. They require a greater balance in the environment. And they require almost a distinct collective balance between the thought of the group soul that they're connected with and communicating with and the thought of the divonic energy inside the plant itself. Those two have to be so well balanced that these beings, these super etherics that are along the fourth ray that tend to produce the best herbal plants, are like specialized. They usually don't mess with anything other than certain kinds of herbal plants, and they produce magical, almost, substances inside the plants that comes from this balance that I just described and the way it gets balanced that can cure things that no pharmaceutical is going to be able to cure, that literally produces amazing, wonderful effects in other living things. Even sometimes it can help other plants as a substance. So these are the most wonderful substances. And the funny thing about it is there are thousands of these kinds of herbal substances. And if you took them collectively, they may actually treat and cure everything that we call illness in all forms of life. Now, why is that true? Well, it's a pretty far-fetched statement. It's because the way that the super etheric divonic energies that are forthright work is they balance every negative element in their specialization collectively averaged out between every group soul in every plant, which covers almost every kind of way that negative energy can be used. So in an odd way, if you were writing the Bible, it says it this way, there is a series of plants to cure every illness. And the Hebrew Bible says that. So, I mean, it's true. But whoever came up with that, if they knew the reasons that I explained in tonight's show, they know an awful lot about metaphysics. So, and it probably did come from that source, but that's a whole other show, right? Okay, so if we're dealing with this from this particular standpoint, then, it's a combination of these that are needed for illnesses. You will not find one plant producing one source of an herb that probably is going to cure a lot of different things and maybe won't cure any one thing without being used with other herbs. So it's a combining of herbs that produces these cures, and that's where the Fai Chi thing comes in. Now, herbalists have known this for a long time, but they haven't had a science to deal with it because they don't understand all the ray issues. Some of them, most of them don't. And so you have to understand how the body works. It's a science, so you have to have some Western understanding of anatomy and chemistry and biochemistry. And put that together with the metaphysical side to be able to really look at this from the total picture. If you do, it is possible to actually figure out a combination of herbs to treat anything that is wrong with either a human being or any other form of life. This is the amazing thing about it. We are talking about the fundamental ways that energy affects everything in its ability to stay alive, and plants are the chemical factories that produce these wonderful substances, but they only do so with the help of the divonic part of the energy kingdom. Without the divonic part, the plants can't do it because they need the help between the group souls and the energies that are inside of them to make it all work out together. And they can't do it if human beings are interfering with them and dumping all kinds of chemicals on them or changing everything about their environment in some way that's negative for them. Even our attitude about them, though, affects the divonic energies that the super etheric divonic energies that are helping them. And so the plants are directly affected by how we think and feel about them all the time, whether they live in our house or in the outside world or wherever. And that has as much an effect on the plants as whether we water them or not. Although certainly that's going to have an effect on them because it shows our sentiment towards them. You know, if we say, well, I'm not going to water you today because I don't feel like it. So what if you're going to die? Or maybe you're going to lose some leaves or something. Well, that's a very bad thing for the plant, but it's going to be bad for you too if you're in the same demonic energy region when you have those feelings. Because there's a feedback. Remember that. If you have plants in your house and you have negative feelings either about the plant or about something else, even, and you adversely affect the plants, the divinic energies that are working with the plants are going to negatively affect you. So plants could be guardians, in a sense. You put beautiful plants around nice people. When bad people come around, they may not feel so good, and they won't. And they'll be repelled by the energy of the demonic beings around those plants. They act like guardians. You think I'm crazy? Okay, do this experiment. Make a kind of ugly place, and then make a beautiful place. They could be fairly close to each other, but so that you don't have too many extraneous circumstances. And see how many really hostile, negative people go towards the ugly place compared to the beautiful place. It may surprise you. Beauty is a protection against ugliness and darkness. It's not perfect. And if the ugliness and darkness is strong enough, it can go in and do some harm. Not without losing sense in the process. I guarantee that. Remember, the loss of sense is one of the first things that the divinic energies can affect. And so the reason they do that is to protect the plants that they are working with. Because if you lose your sense, you can't even figure out how to harm the plants. And you're more worried about just staying alive then and whether or not you're going to go harm some plants, you see. Also, people who wantonly destroy food plants are also seen as equally dark. So be aware that if you say, well, gee, I just like to go chop up some banana plants or take some oranges and throw them at cars or something, that will cost you, especially if you're in a relatively nice part of the world and you take that and try to make it ugly and do ugly things with it. Your intent is picked up, not just the action. Divinic energies sense both the sentiment, astral feelings especially, as well as some mental thoughts, not that much, and our etheric feelings, we'll call it, our sensible feelings, and how those are taking action or inaction that is either helping to create beauty or be destructive. All that together is sensed by the divinic energies that are interacting with the plants. The plants are getting it from them. Remember, they do not have a nervous system like we do. Their nervous system is the divinic energies that are super etheric around them. And somewhat, to a much smaller extent, the ones that are inside them as well. But it's not really like an etheric system to them. It just helps them to create some elements of movement in them without having any nervous system. And the component of our nervous system, just so you know, that is the equivalent, is our etheric nervous system, which is part of our aura and part of our centers or chakras, and the minor chakras, of which there are hundreds throughout our body. That when people go for acupuncture, those are being manipulated externally, whereas something like a product made with Tai Chi, it does it internally, affects those minor centers internally, which then goes back to one or more of the major centers. They're all interconnected. A minor center has no consciousness, whereas the major centers have consciousness. The centers with consciousness, if they are attacked by a super etheric being, has dramatic effects on our consciousness and our sense in general that center is feeding into. So that could be really serious. I mean, you could lose your sight or at least diminishment or your hearing. The minor centers, it just causes you and leaves you more open for illness. and a decrease in health, a decrease in stamina, a loss in adaptability. So you could cause either one of those kinds of things if you have negative, but if you have positive, it does the reverse. So positive causes the minor centers will improve health oftentimes. Or if you go in with a really good place and do the right things, in or around plants, then the results will be a vast improvement potentially in senses, which and I'm talking about the senses everybody's familiar with, including the astral ones. And the results will be an increased life expectancy, not just a question of health, although that will improve as well, but more than that, we'll call it a significant improvement in the overall longevity of the person themselves. Now, why did I spend so much time talking about people? Because even though there's a lot more I could explain tonight, or could have explained instead, about the interrelationship of energy and plant kingdoms and how it affects the minerals and animals, etc., people who listen to this show usually want to know how it's going to affect them, because no matter how much we would like to think that we just want to know everything about everything, we really want to relate it to ourselves to make sure that in some way it's doing what it should do to try to improve us. And that's just, it's the nature of us. We are individuals. We think of ourselves at least as much as we think of anything else. So I do it for that reason, not because I'm trying to only talk about it in that respect. So I got a couple of minutes here. Let me just try to talk about it in terms of the other parts of life. I really won't do justice to this because I don't have enough time to do it. But birds are very much affected by, especially birds that are fourth-rate, but even fifth-rate birds, like talking birds are usually fifth-rate, but they're attracted to plants, and they have a very strong relationship with the divinic energies of plants. That's the reason birds prefer to live in trees in comparison to cages or birdhouses. Now, you can make a birdhouse if it has a nice garden around it, probably habitable by birds. But in general, they prefer trees and other kinds of plants. The reason for that is they don't survive just by eating things from trees or even living in trees because they're kind of comfy. They hold some heat in and other things, because you could give them a very, very nice house that might do that. They would still prefer the tree. And the reason is because the tree has such strong super-etheric energy. They have some very strong beings that, you know, are divinic around it. Birds are unique in that they live mostly in the air, and the air is closer in respect. Most birds do. Some are walking around just on the ground, but most birds live in the air. And they have a more, we'll say, symbiotic relationship with these super-etheric beings, which also are living sort of in the air, but they're in etheric air. But still, the bird can sense etherically better than we can because of that nature. They have a very strong etheric sense. And so their bodies are bathed, literally, by these super-etheric beings that they are with. And they usually tend to be very protective of where they, you know, live in trees, etc. And they have great attachment to these plants. Not too long ago, I had to cut down a tree that was kind of in a bad place doing a bad thing. And it was unfortunate. A particular bird was living in that tree, and it was like lost. It found another tree to live in. It was smaller. But it missed its biggest being that it was involved with. And so some animals have a peculiarly strong sense of plant super etheric devas that are in an amazing way. The strong divinic energy provides them with half of their life. It actually keeps them going beyond just the food they eat and the water they may drink. So it has a very big effect on birds. Now, there are other animals this is true of, and I can't go through all of them. I don't have the time, but I'm giving you an example so that you realize that it isn't just human beings that are affected by this huge amount of energy. It's the reason that animals are usually attracted to what we call forested areas more than places that are just rocky, etc. Now, the animals that require less, we'll call it balance in the etheric energies, and less, we'll call it less need for balance in their pranic energies, too, are usually reptilian and more primitive, and they can live in areas that are not as etherically endowed. That doesn't mean they wouldn't live in an etherically endowed place, but they can find other places where they can do okay. Insects also, and spiders, and centipedes, et cetera, and flying stuff, you know, different insects. All of them, they can go almost anywhere because their primitive nature is such that they don't need a very strong etheric connection to stay alive. Part of it is because they have a very limited nervous system themselves. So they have a strong connection with flowers and with plants in general, but they don't need as much etheric energy because their nervous systems are very, very narrow and basic in comparison. And they also can relate to things that don't have nervous systems because they have such a primitive one. So there's a kind of almost, we'll call it, symbiotic relationship there. And also they do have group souls, and they sometimes, some of them, more advanced forms of them actually do have sometimes a super etheric, demonic energy that helps them. Bees collectively sometimes have this for them. So it's something to consider, and it's not true of all insects. It's only true of certain ones, and I don't have time to go through all that tonight. But anyway, so there you can see that the energy part of existence has a lot of intertwining, complicated things that it does with other forms of life besides just plants and, of course, humans. And there's so much more that we could talk about, but we're really running out of time, that would probably give a broader idea about tonight's show. But at any rate, I hope that this has covered this subject enough so that it's filled in some spots, some blanks, some holes that people have had about how all of this stuff fits together and why herbs work and why plants are so important and why, if we don't pay attention to this, maybe we can harm ourselves both as a race and a species, but also, more importantly, is a major part of life. If we do understand it, we can improve all of life, especially plants. But all of life can be improved by thinking about everything I said in tonight's show and creatively applying it in different ways, by first testing it and then by using it in a whole bunch of different things that I didn't even get to touch on tonight. And maybe I shouldn't. Maybe that should be left up for all of you to figure out. Well, we are out of time, believe it or not. I went as fast as I could tonight without, I think, losing anybody. So we did cover a lot of things, and that's good. And until next week, and a lot of time to think about this, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.